You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2023 Giro d'Italia. Today we are in Bergamo.
Right, Daniel, I think this is it. This is the breakaway group coming up here to the narrow passageway up to Bergamo Alto. You see the first riders now. Situation here, a lot of fans cheering on the riders on the steeper ramps on the way up here to Bergamo Alto. Che spettacolo, Daniel.
O'Brien, buonasera. That was you this afternoon in Bergamo, in the Città Alta. You were mixing with the locals, the natives, very much enjoying yourself, it sounded like, weren't you?
Daniel, I had an ace of a time. I haven't been that close to a bike race maybe since Giro d'Emilia last year, you know, when it finishes on the San Luca climb in Bologna. And this felt very similar.
You've been at the Giro d'Italia for the last 2.5 weeks.
I know, but so have you. Have you seen any interesting bike racing?
Well, not interesting, but I've seen plenty of bike racing.
Yeah, but today was, you know, with the circuit up the La Boccola climb, the shooting. We're actually right next to Roglic's fan club camper.
I'm not sure it's his fan club camper. If his fan club consists of his wife, then it is his fan club, because I think that's where his wife,
I mean, if his
travels.
Wife is not a fan of his work,
well, there you go. And Brian, I said you're in the Città Alta earlier.
What a lovely place that is, by the way.
It is very beautiful. If anyone ever goes up there, I've got a restaurant recommendation confirmed actually by Manolo, a good friend who works at Colnago now, and he's a native of Bergamo. And yeah, I said to Manolo earlier, I always eat in Damimmo in the Città Alta, and he said, ottimo posto,
someone else
great
actually
place.
Recommended it. But I also have to say, and this is, I'm not trying to, you know, gain some extra sort of sympathy here, I took the Funivia up there,
yeah,
which is basically like a sardine can gondola that, yeah, pulls you all the way up. Scary experience, but I did it so I could go and record for us.
Yes, you did. What's that got to do with restaurant recommendations in the,
because
Città
when I'm standing there, one of our Danish listeners recommended the exact same restaurant.
Ah, okay. We got there in the end. Brian, we are now in the American Bar. True story. Actually called the American Bar. It's right outside the press room, somewhere down in the Città Bassa, in the low part of Bergamo. Why is this appropriate, Brian? Well, because we've seen a stage victory by an American. And that American was Brandon McNulty. We've seen an exciting stage as well, but exciting in the same way that yesterday was exciting. We saw a pulsating race at the front end of proceedings. We didn't see too much at the back end of proceedings. We wanted both today, really, didn't we?
Yeah, we were hoping for it.
We treated to a great spectacle in the break. Great spectacle on the sides of the roads. We're going to talk about that as well. Not so much in the GC group, and that is pretty much the story of the Giro as far as the general classification is concerned so far. Brian, without too much further ado, shall we proceed to the tale of the tappa?
It's time for the tale of the tappa.
Thank you, Daniel. So the stage 15, Daniel, from Serenio to Bergamo, all Lombardy today, 195 kilometers. And a very difficult stage with four categorized climbs, and it was more or less up and down all day. I think the total amount of climbing was around 4,000 meters. The first big climb was the category one, Valico di Valcava. Very difficult climb that you remember from your youth when you lived around here, I suppose. Yeah. Basically, attacks from the start, first eight, then seven riders attacks and counterattacks. But eventually, the big group of the day went up the road, 17 riders strong.
Okay.
But we're avoiding all kinds of accidents here. Can I also just add that it's hay fever season? Anyways, those 17 riders, some of them we've seen before in breakaways in the Giro, but there were some very strong candidates for the stage win, potentially also maybe a challenger for the general classification. So some of the big names there was Ben Healy, Albanese, Bonifacio, Marco Frigo, Rubio and Rojas from Movistar, Bauke Mollema and Brandon McNulty. Ben Healy took the first points on the climb up to Valico di Valcava, Rubio right next to him. The best rider in the front group was Aina Rubio. So it's kind of a question of how much line they would give him from the main group. Attackers, a little bit like yesterday, there were a lot of riders, too many probably for them to keep the cooperation going. Ben Healy was the first really to put in a big attack. He actually countered Marco Frigo, who eventually got dropped, and Brandon McNulty came up to him as well. McNulty actually caught him on the descent of the Roncola before the last climb up to Bergamo Alta. It was kind of interesting because Marco Frigo was really trailing behind, and it looked for a long time if he wouldn't come back. They didn't even give him that much camera time, but eventually he was there. And then and coming into the last sort of flat kilometers here in Bergamo, he actually put in what looked like a devastating attack for the stage, basically opening up an early sprint. McNulty had tried his luck 7 kilometers to go with a solo attack, but eventually it was just down to those three guys.
Marco Frigo, yeah. He's from Bassano di Grappa, yeah. Home of one of the most famous bridges in Italy, the Ponte degli Alpini, and he bridged beautifully, didn't he, Brian?
Yeah, he did. Had I only had your academic
spent all
laurels.
Afternoon coming up with that.
Yeah. Exactly. Thank you for that, Daniel. In the sprint, McNulty actually was the fastest, and it was kind of like a little bit of surprise because a lot of people, at least where I was sitting, were thinking that this could be McNulty's second win. Well, it wasn't. Huge win for UAE, and it was kind of the first time McNulty had really been given the liberty to chase the stage, and he certainly came home with a big win because of it. So in the main group, because there was a gap of some 7 minutes, I think. Yeah, seven and a half minutes almost. There wasn't really any action until the last time up to La Boccola. And as it went, you know, Roglic started to move, Almeida started to move, but all the GC riders stayed quite close. So some like 9 riders or so that broke loose. Eventually, Dunbar, Van Wilde, Roglic, Geraint Thomas, Almeida, Caruso, Leknesson, again very impressive. But they only sort of got a little bit of a gap, and the rest of the GC contenders, would say like the bulk of the top 20 riders, they all came in. There's just a small, tiny gap. So it wasn't to be for the GC riders. And yeah, Bruno Mirai, thanks to the work that he did, that his team did during the day, keeps the jersey with a comfortable margin. So I wouldn't say a big bag of nothing, but a lot less than we had hoped for, also as you mentioned in your introduction.
Brian, let's look at the general classification. Well, in fact, if you're looking for a rider who made any ground on general classification, you have to go way down to Aina Rubio, who, by virtue of being that break, moved up 4 places. He's now 14th on the GC. There were others that lost just a couple of seconds. Thibaut Pinot, I think he was in the group that lost. Did they lose 1 second in the end or 2 seconds? 2 seconds. Pinot, Jack Haig was in there as well. Kemna, Sepp Kuss, Hugh Carthy. They came in just 2 seconds behind the Roglic and Thomas group. But not exactly what we were expecting on the general classification. We hoped that we would see a bit of a sort out today. Certainly Bergamo turned out as we thought that it would on a Sunday, the first sunny day of this year. The first sunny day of this year, really, since the opening time trial.
Today, at least from the ambience and from...
You know, it felt like the Giro.
Yeah, exactly. It felt like the Giro, and Bergamo has such a big heart for cycling. It's a really important town for, you know, not just in Lombardia, but just in general, all the champions that have come from here. So at least the city did what they were expected to. But, you know, the GC riders, in a way you could say they
didn't. For various reasons that we'll find out about in a minute. Well, Brian, I propose that we hear first from Marco Frigo, who is in only his first year as a professional, and once upon a time it was very rare for a neo-pro to even ride a Grand Tour. He's come relatively close twice now. He was close on the stage to Rivoli, finished 5th there. He was in the break and very strong. And today was 3rd. We're going to hear from him. Then we're going to hear from his director sportif, Sam Bewley, who is also in his first Grand Tour, but as a director sportif. Of course, had a long and distinguished career, particularly with your former team, Orica GreenEdge, Brian. And he's entertained a lot of people on this Giro d'Italia with the GoPro clips from inside the Israel Premier Tech team car.
The last time the breakaway went. when he talked to Marco Frigo, that was the...
No, that wasn't Marco Frigo. That was Berrick.
Oh, that was Berrick. That's right.
Yeah, Sebastian Berrick. He sort of... well, in.
Can you do a big recap of what he told him?
Well, he told him that he shouldn't worry about not coming through and doing his turn in the break, and that it was only 7 kilometres until the finish. He was a great bloke, basically. Can't really do a New Zealand accent. But he could afford to be it. An asshole.
For 7 kilometres. What a quote.
So he's been entertaining everyone with those videos from inside the team cars. And we're going to hear it from Marco Frigo first and Sam Bewley. I should also add that Sam Bewley, well, he's been in the team car when Derek G has finished second 3 times now. So we'll hear from those two. And then we're going to hear from Geraint Thomas about exactly what was going on in that GC group and why we didn't see a little bit more action. And then later on in the episode, we're going to get the Jumbo-Visma perspective.
Marco, more pride or disappointment coming so close?
For sure more pride. In the end, I did the best to win the stage, and I was close, but I'm happy.
And how much confidence are you getting from the last few days? I mean, you've been very close to some of the best breakaway riders in the world.
Yeah, of course. I had confidence already the last week because of the bad, good feeling I had. Today was my day to try to win. I was close, and that's it, now in cycling.
Sam, you're pretty new in this, well, second career as a direct sportif, and we've all been enjoying, what, vicariously experiencing some of the anxiety on those GoPro videos. But today, again, same thing, but you're still standing.
Yeah, man, it's been a hell of a Giro for us, actually. And, you know, it's like when we got second that first day with Derek, it was obviously like, massive elation, huge ride on the podium for Derek, and then it's just sort of been that theme for about 6 days now, and it's kind of a double-edged sword. Like, we're obviously so happy with how the team's riding, and it's a real pleasure to be at this Giro with a bunch of young guys and a couple of more experienced dudes that just want to get out there and race their bikes, and you know that's what it's all about, and that's what we're trying to build in this team. And again, so agonizingly close again today, but man, it's just great to see the fight from these guys.
And well, he tried with the counter there, presumably. Well, it was the obvious move, and presumably that was the message coming from the car.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was an obvious move, and it was really the only move in the situation like that. When you're coming back with, you know, with more speed than the two guys in front on a downhill sprint, you've just got to take that speed and go, no matter how far away it is from the finish line. And yeah, it was the right move, but unfortunately, yeah, those guys just managed to, you know, have a little bit more speed in the end. And hats off to McNulty and to Healy as well. They were super strong today, and yeah, we were close, but we'll keep trying.
And well, we enjoyed your 7 kilometres of being an asshole the other day. What was the message today? Was there any gems you came out with today?
Oscar was on the radio today, and I was just taking the piss out of his English. So that's about it.
Geraint, talk us through the last sort of 30, 40K. That was where we thought that we might see it kick off, but a bit of a stalemate in the end.
Yeah, it's a funny one, really. We were kind of expecting something, but you know, FDJ controlled the brake well, and everyone just seemed content to sit in the wheels, and it's never easy, but you know, it was just a steady pace all day, and yeah, I was expecting something on the last climb, but it didn't materialize. And with the last week being so hard, maybe everyone's like biding their time for that, I don't know. But yeah, and then the last little kicker is not all you can do when everyone's fresh, or me anyway.
Jumbo-Visma did go to the front on the Ronkel, and it looked as though they were going to force it for a while, but that ended pretty quickly. What was going on there, do you think?
I think it was just a bit of stress fighting for position, really. You know, Bora and UAE, similar thing, a bit of a drag race. We tried to just sit back a bit and bide our time because, yeah, there was no point in doing that, really. And then, yeah, as I say, the main part of the day was that race into the right-hander with 5K to go.
Geraint, at this point, so close to the lead, 2 weeks into the Giro. I mean, deep down before this race, did you think you might be in such a good position, or is this a big surprise even to you?
To be honest, I came into the race thinking, try and limit my losses the first 2 weeks and hopefully I'll have good legs at the end. And yeah, to be in front of all the main rivals is certainly a nice bonus. This race is going to explode at one point. Hopefully I'm at the right end of that. Yeah, it's a bit of a waiting game at the minute, but I think next week with, is it 3-4 mountaintops with the TT? It's a hell of a lot can happen. Team dynamics as well, how people are feeling. And like yesterday, for instance, I didn't want to burn all the guys to keep the jersey when they're rotating so quick in front. So it's kind of, at the end of the day, it's not just me. So you need to use the team to set me up. So it's kind of getting us all into that last week as best as possible. And then So yeah, I guess I am content to wait for now, and hopefully it's he can do something.
I hope you see Roglic, because he's not moving either. You know, usually he can be more aggressive, but he's not moving. I don't know.
Yeah, surprised by it, to be honest. Like, maybe he's learned from, you know, last time he did the Giro, he kind of went at it quite early and then died off. Or maybe he's just suffering a bit with the crashes. I guess it's one for him, really, isn't it? But
any more mind games from him this week? Any self-declared positive COVID tests, anything like that?
No, it's just everyone's just sort of eyeing each other up and sort of talking a bit of rubbish, but we'll see.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2023 Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Pavel Sivakov rides for Ineos Grenadiers, who are supplied by our sponsors, Science in Sport. So Science in Sport are keeping the Ineos riders on the road, just as they are keeping the Cycling Podcast on the airwaves. Now, I asked Pavel what he had learned about nutrition since he turned pro and what have been the biggest changes in nutrition strategy, but also the products.
Well, I learned a lot, to be honest. Like, before I joined the team, I think I didn't have the knowledge I have today. And there's been quite a few changes also in the nutrition approach. And I think it's actually linked to the change in the racing, to be honest. Like, we've seen in the past few years, the racing has become much more, like, let's say, aggressive. Like, let's say when I joined the team, there was a lot of focus on the low carb, like quite a lot of low carb rides, and we restricted the carb much more. And now in the past like couple of years is actually completely opposite approach. It's like we train to absorb and to eat as much carbs as we can.
So a few years ago, the low-carb diet was the thing and carbs were almost the enemy. Now, carbs are king. And if you want to load up for your ride, the Beta Fuel gels have 40 grams of dual carbohydrates proven to deliver maximal energy with minimal stomach discomfort. Go to scienceinsport.com for the full range.
Well, Brian, before the short commercial interlude there, we heard from Geraint Thomas. And very interesting, he was as well on today's stage, but
it's quite rare that you hear riders also wondering the tactical dispositions of their closest competitors.
Indeed. We're going to get onto that in a minute, but just before we do, I'm flicking through today's Eco di Bergamo. Now, we said that Bergamo is really a cycling heartland in Italy. In the 90s, we talked about this yesterday. There was a time where I think there was this statistic that I remember where Bergamo had more bike shops per square kilometer than anywhere else in the world. It's a bit of a, I'm not going to say a faded heartland, but there certainly aren't as many pros living here as there used to be. We established that yesterday. We talked about the fact that Lorenzo Rota does live here. Today, for example, I went up to Selvino, and you know, on the Selvino is sort of the Alpe d'Huez of Lombardy.
It looks the part too.
Yeah, and it has this fantastic sequence of hairpins, and each hairpin is dedicated to a cyclist who hails from Bergamo. And just driving up there today, that really put in perspective what a rich heritage this region has. Then I went through, after the Miragolo San Salvatore, I went through Sedrina, which of course is where Felice Gimondi grew up, and this is the first time Giro's been back to Bergamo, I believe, since his death in 2019, or that we've had a stage here. Well, this newspaper today, the local newspaper, is just a sort of panoply of articles, information about precisely that. This city's extremely rich heritage in cycling. Also, some interesting nuggets in here, like the cost of hosting a stage of the Giro d'Italia, a Sunday stage, which is more expensive than other stages. Bergamo paid €300,000 to host this stage today. So, you know, we talked the other day, didn't we, about what is the Giro dead? We had our kilometer zero, La Corsa Rota, and we mentioned the fact that the Giro actually financially is doing pretty well. And we talked about things like the Grande Partenza all'estero, the foreign Grande Partenzas, and that's a big money spinner. But days like today are big money spinners as well.
Yeah, I think also when often you kind of wonder what the tourist perspective would be when you see some of the places we go to, not that they don't have their own local charm, but not necessarily something that would make you change your holiday plans. But today we really saw Bergamo and all its beauty, I think. I love a city circuit the way that it's today, like, or a city climbing stage. Aren't that many places where you can do that. You could maybe do it in Como, close to here as well. So I think that they made the most of it. It's definitely, well, for me, because I was so close to the race for once, it was definitely one to remember.
It was a route that we believed, we hoped, was conducive to some movement on general classification. Also becoming before a rest day, we thought that, you know, even the riders themselves, even Thomas and Roglic themselves have been talking about how everyone's playing this waiting game.
Yeah.
So everything was set up for a bit of a sort out today. But was the course really conducive to it? We heard Geraint Thomas say that even he was slightly mystified as to why this race has not sparked into life already. Mystified on the one hand, but also on the other hand, explaining that the two mountain stages we've had so far, Gran Sasso d'Italia and Col Montana, have been very much influenced by the weather and the wind.
I think there's more to that as well. So, for instance, on Ride today, in the discussion they had after the stage, they were very heated discussions. Garcelli, Pitaki, and the hosts, they were saying, "Well, no, why doesn't anyone want the pink jersey? Why is it not more was a more desired object in this race?" Well, the one of the reasons for that is that it's so close. And Garcelli said something I thought was quite interesting. They said, "Well, no one wants to crack trying when you know what's coming up. And the last week is so ridiculously hard. The amount of effort and risk you bring upon yourself and your team to take the jersey now with a small gap doesn't necessarily repay itself in how much you have left in the tank for the last week." If there's any merit to that, if that is truth being spoken, then I think we'll hopefully get it at some point, because I'm sure someone wants to have the pink jersey in Rome. It's just a question of when does the lid sort of come off the bottle? When does the cork pop?
Ah, Mattia Galli, agent of Primoz Roglic. He doesn't like giving interviews. Mattia. No. Buonasera. Almeno la buonasera.
Buonasera, sì.
Buonasera.
Buonasera.
Where's my Rivella?
In Switzerland.
No, it's in Foggia.
As well, in Foggia.
He has two stashes of Rivella.
Which color?
Blue. Blue. How's Primoz? How's Primoz?
Doing well.
That's the most reluctant interview person I've ever met.
Ti lasciamo andare, dai.
Grazie.
You think so?
Wow.
He says he's already said too much.
Wow.
Well, I mean, in Roglic terms, that's probably compares to some of his interviews, but yeah. It wasn't much.
All that was missing was the you know what I mean, huh?
Yeah.
Brian, I can't remember where we were.
I think you stopped paying attention when I was referring to the intricacies of the coming Giro stages, the power balance in the race, the arm wrestle, and the fact that it seems like no one wants the pink jersey.
It's too close. It is the problem with this Giro d'Italia, paradoxically, and you can look at this in two ways. You can see it as and I think that when I think back to the interviews that people like Mauro Vegni, the Giro director, have given over the past few years, they've really emphasized this how close the race has been as a virtue. But it's not always a virtue, is it? It's a virtue if, you know, you're seeing a sort of a ding-dong battle. It's going back and forth. Someone's gaining a few seconds one day. The other person or the other riders are gaining those seconds back another day. But this race is just stuck in a stasis, isn't it?
Yeah, and yeah, for the moment it certainly is.
And there are no two ways around it. It hasn't been that entertaining so far. And, you know, the second time trial in particular, they would have, certainly Mauro Vegni would have looked at that as, well, probably the first big sort out. Maybe they hope that would be the case with Gran Sasso as well. They thought that might create big time gaps. But when we spoke to coaches in the teams, physiologists in the teams and direct sportifs, they all knew, because they have this ability to model now. They were under no illusions about that second time trial creating big time gaps. They knew that it was going to be incredibly close. And this was quite predictable, that we would get to this point in the race with very little between the top riders.
Yeah, I still believe that if Evenepoel had been up to his best and not had COVID, he would have gone way faster, and he would have had to, potentially. So that's one thing.
And that would have made today's stage quite different.
Yes. And secondly, had Tao Gegenhardt still been in the race at some point, maybe not today, but it could have been, depending on how Remco was feeling or whatever. This is all hypothetical, subjunctive conditionals, it's called in semantic philosophy. But it actually meant, you know, you can't take those pieces out. This guy's gone, that guy's gone, it's been raining, it's not, that doesn't really have, it's not Mauro Vigna's fault that people get COVID, crash and fall out, and the weather is quite adverse. So I think there's also, some of it is the layout of the race, and some of it is contingencies.
Brian, we have, we'll talk about this stasis in the general classification. We've heard from Geraint Thomas. Let's get the Jumbo-Visma perspective now, slightly more detailed than what Mattia Galli, Primoz Roglic just gave us. Let's hear from Marc Rafe, their direct sportif, who's becoming a familiar voice on the podcast. We're hearing from him a lot.
Marc, what was happening on the Roncola there when Jumbo-Visma went to the front? It looked as though you wanted to force the pace and then you backed off.
Yeah, I think that at that moment FDG went off with their guys, and it was searching for the moment who would take initiative to set the pace on the climb. They were searching for each other. I think that one guy went to the front to the other side to search for Primoz again, and then it was waiting for the moment that somebody was doing it, and that didn't happen.
Was it ever your plan to attack Thomas today and attack Ineos?
We also saw that the parcours had quite some valley roads in between, and you can attack then, but yeah, if they find each other still in the back, it's really difficult to really make a big difference. So also the stage was not really suited. FDG took control over the day. They did that on a very good way. It was not anymore for the stage win. So in the end, it just came down to the final climb. There they raced a bit to each other, but it was also too short to really make a big difference.
Geraint Thomas said he thinks maybe Primoz has learned lessons from the past, that he's riding more conservatively, waiting more because of some of his experiences in the past. Is that accurate?
I think that also what you have seen the last 2 weeks, up front the parcours was really suited for already the fights between the GC riders, but in the end, with the headwind on the Gran Sasso, with the headwind 2 days ago on Crans-Montana, yeah, it was difficult to make a really big difference. Also, the stage was shortened there, so the 5,000 altitude meter stage, what was planned to be really hard, was only two climbs and a stage of 2 hours. Yeah, it's different to really make a big difference yet between the guys, and it's just waiting for the last week. Yeah, we didn't have to spend a lot of energy yet. We took one time the initiative on stage 8 to Fossombrone. I think that also Primoz showed there that he was strong. And now it's just waiting for the moment. And yes, we are content with how it is at the moment. The GC guys are still short. We are 2 seconds away from Thomas, and everything is okay for the moment.
So Brian, there we heard that Jumbo-Visma, well, they had a nibble, they had a look, purely because they sensed, they felt that Groupama, FDJ, they'd done their work. They stopped pulling.
They stopped pulling when they knew that Rubio was not going to be a threat to Amirai's pink jersey. So that makes sense. And I think, and also looking at Amirai's possibilities going into the last week, they're meager at best.
He rode a great race.
Very heroic.
Fantastic.
And, yeah, absolutely. But just to say that they couldn't be blamed for having used up their energy or deciding not to take control of the race when the GC riders would start to attack each other. So I think that's perfectly as it should be, on their behalf at least.
Brian, when Ben Healy won his first stage, we lauded and we celebrated. We're very impressed by the way that he grasped the nettle so early. And that was a risk that day. And we felt that he could have probably gone to the finish in a small group and won, or gone close to the finish in a small group and dropped them on the final climb. Today, how did you assess the way he played his cards?
I actually thought about it because they did the La Boccola, the climb up to the old town here in Bergamo twice. So he obviously had seen it once before. And I think he was a little bit too optimistic about his possibilities to drop, especially McNulty, with just one acceleration. And then I think when he saw he couldn't do that, he worked a lot to establish the breakaway. He worked a lot to reduce the group. I just think he ran out of difficult parts at the end to really make a difference.
Well, let's not take anything away from Brandon McNulty, who's a rider who I think his palmarès doesn't really do justice to his value as a rider and where we think he's going in his career. I mean, he's still only 25 years old. He's got a contract with UAE Team Emirates until 2024. With Almeida there, Pogacar there, you still feel that in the future, his latitude to lead the team is going to be pretty limited. He doesn't have the ability. I mean, I think he does have the ability to be a leader somewhere else. He's a good time trialist. He's a good climber. And he hasn't really had an opportunity. He hasn't gone into a Grand Tour with complete freedom to explore his own potential as a GC rider. He never will if he stays where he is.
With UAE, no. Depending on where Adam Yates goes, I'm not convinced that Pogacar's going to ride three Grand Tours a season. But they're also going to focus on having the strongest riders next to him. They have a Ayuso as well. It's probably one of the biggest potentials in Grand Tours as well. And has proved it already at a very young age at the Vuelta last year. So I think Brandon McNulty is probably at the part of his career now where he would be expected to win Paris-Nice. He would be expected to win.
I was going to say, because he has been given some opportunities, but in smaller races. And I just wonder whether races like the Volta a la Comunitat Valenciana, I think he was UAE's leader there, and he came in eighth in general classification, which, okay, if you go back and look at sort of all his results on pro cycling stats, it looks like a really solid performance. But if his end game was to carve out more space for himself, did he need to win a race like that or finish in the top three of a race like that?
You know, when he was a young rider, he was the arch rival of Mikkel Bjerre for the junior and under 23 time trial world championships. And both of them were traded one year and etc. The next year the other one took it. But both of them weren't great riders to ride in a peloton initially, because they also turned pros relatively young. And both of them have really like become fantastic to move around in the peloton. So it's some riders have a slow development. I would be very surprised if McNulty's numbers aren't sky high. I think he has huge physical potential. He's there already, but race wise, he still needs that breakthrough. And he got it. At least he got it today. You know, I think he will only go upwards from here.
It's quite surprising that when you look at his record in Grand Tours, I think his best finish overall in a Grand Tour at this point is 19th overall in the Tour de France last year, which again doesn't. Oh, 15th, sorry, in the Giro d'Italia in 2020. But that.
So what was he last year in the Tour?
19th in the Tour last year. Obviously working for Pogacar.
Yeah, they lost so many riders to COVID in the Tour last year. We already almost forgot. So the amount of work that he had to do last year, the Tour, was tremendous. And that he was able to finish that high up, I mean, that's impressive in itself when you take the context into consideration.
La Renzando, a postcard from Italy. With Larry Warbass.
Not all superheroes wear capes, but our superhero wears a brown one. Yeah. Larry, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I don't know what happened today. The meteorologist messed up again.
Talk to us about last night. Yesterday you were in buoyant mood, having got in the break, but then you were a little bit disappointed you didn't have the legs to follow. Just take us inside your mind last night and what were you thinking about the stage?
Yeah, I mean, I was glad to get in there. I was a little bit disappointed to miss out on a chance for a result, and I like rewatched the end of the stage, and I definitely kind of fucked up in my positioning and stuff coming into the end. And if you don't have incredible legs, then yeah, you can't really make errors like that. So yeah, I was a little bit disappointed. I think with the guys I was with, I don't think I would have had a chance to go for the win, but I mean, maybe a top five or something would have been nice. So missed out on that, but yeah, there's still more chances, and I'm hoping on a day that might suit me a little bit better, I can get in there. So
is your mood very much about, well, yesterday doesn't suggest this is the case, but about survival, or are you still very much thinking about results and performing? It's not just about sort of rolling in zombie fashion to Rome now. I mean, because often that's the case at this point in a Grand Tour. I mean, people on the internet and whatever, they might think, oh, so-and-so, you know, he could get a result in that stage. But we see you guys in the morning, and we know that for some of you, it's just rolling, like, as I say, in zombie fashion.
When it goes hard, I feel pretty strong. I think I'm probably, you know, among the 50 strongest guys, which means that, like, you're not doing so badly. maybe I don't have the same legs as the leaders, but yeah, I'm doing just fine. So, but I think this Giro, honestly, a lot of it is just about survival, so you can get that chance, because, like, as we can see, it's pouring rain again, unexpectedly this time. It's funny, I was telling one of my teammates yesterday, who was, you know, writing me, he's not here, and he asked me, you know, how it's going and how miserable it looks, and I said, yeah, you know, it's like every other year you have one day that's just so terrible and miserable on the bike that you think, like, wow, I don't know how we did that, you know, like, I don't know if I could do that again. That's literally how it is every single day here, you know. I mean, yesterday I was in the break and I was so absolutely frozen and shivering and miserable at the bottom of the descent that I literally, a moment I was like, well, at least if I have to stop and change all my clothes, like, I have 6 minutes before the bunch catches me, you know, like, so, you know, it's like, it's hard to think about going for a stage win when you're just thinking about surviving at the same time. So anyone who finishes this Giro can do probably anything in life, because it's a mental battle here every day.
I mean, you and I have already agreed that David Goggins would have loved this Giro, wouldn't he? I mean,
yeah.
Have you washed down your suck it up pill with a can of hard this morning?
I mean, I'll be honest, once the rain started again, I was like, wow, I think my body's gonna stop deciphering between wet and dry now, because, like, yeah, it's broken.
Well, Brian, good to hear that our good friend, the Motown Maestro, Larry Warbass, is still feeling pretty bullish about the rest of this race. And, well, Larry will enjoy, I think, the terrain we've got coming over the last week. We heard Geraint Thomas earlier refer to the 4 summit finishes we've got still to come.
In 6 days.
Yeah, if you include the Monte Lusardi. And, again, talking about the route and why the race has been sort of almost neutralised on general classification. Again, the Giro, in its messaging, in its narrative, has made a virtue of backloading the race. It's done that for many years now. I think that trend really accelerated with Angelo Zomagnan, and absolutely, when he was the race director for a couple of years.
He just couldn't. It was almost like he had to, like, do it harder every year.
Yeah.
To the point where it became ridiculous, because it actually meant that the race was so hard in the last week that it actually took the edge of the racing. They didn't race more because the parkour was hard. They don't get extra strength because there's more climbs they have to do. And something that we often forget, even us who follow the sport closely, doesn't mean that they sort of find extra abilities because the parkour is harder. It's on the contrary.
Well, Brian, and it all kicks off, the last week all kicks off with that stage to Monte Bondone in Trentino on Tuesday. And it's not tomorrow's stage, but we're going to treat it as tomorrow's stage because it's a rest day for us tomorrow. No press conference for us tomorrow because, well, we've had a busy week. We've got a busy day tomorrow. We're going to real press conferences, not these sort of fake, tippy-tappy, self-purported press conferences that we do. And we're going to real press conferences. So no press conferences for us tomorrow. So tomorrow, as far as we're concerned, is Tuesday and it is the Monte Bondone stage.
La tappa di domani e la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Brian, before we get to Monte Bondone, yesterday's dinner.
Yesterday's dinner? I forgot. Can you help me out?
Yesterday's dinner, we were eating at Trattoria.
Yeah,
we even heard the waiter, our host last night, talk us through the menu. We were in an Emiliana Trattoria, so the region around Bologna.
Bologna embassy in the Brianza.
Yes, it was. And we had some torta frita, which has got all sorts of different names. It's basically deep fried squares of dough. It's actually a lot lighter than it sounds, isn't it?
And nice and salty.
It's got all sorts of different names depending on which city in Emilia Romagna you're in. It can be called Chisolino, Crescentina, torta frita,
pasta frita, gnocco frito, in Pisa, where I lived.
Pasta frita. So that was very good. I had tortelli, filled pasta with erbette, so kind of spinach and stuff like that. Also, a delicacy, typical of Emilia. Brian, what did you have? Can I remember?
I had sort of a plate with some ham, like from the Spalla San Salvatore was called. And I think actually that was where the pasta frita came in. So you were just allowed to have some of it. There was a whole pile of it. And then I had, being at a restaurant from Bolognese origin, I obviously had the tagliatelle al ragù. Delightful red wine, and I had a licorice amaro. So it's like a liqueur of sorts. I think at that point you'd already gone to bed.
Wasn't as good as our amaro al peperoncino. We had a chili amaro at lunchtime, which was fantastic. Brian, let's talk about Tuesday stage, shall we? Montebondone, a very famous stage, or very famous summit finish for the Giro d'Italia, scene of very famous exploit by Charlie Gall in the 1950s.
It's actually quite a good stage when you look at the layout. You know, we were criticizing the Passo del Sempione yesterday because it was just that one climb and then a long descent into Italy. Here it starts out with almost 60 kilometers of flat, and then there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 climbs in the last 130 kilometers.
Passo di Santa Barbara is not a climb, so that's the first climb on the route. Very difficult. It comes after how many kilometers? 76 kilometers, Brian. Famous, infamous in the Giro d'Italia because it was where, can you remember, Vladimir Belli got kicked out of the Giro in 2001?
Yeah,
because he punched Simone hooligans.
Yeah, I think it wasn't perfectly. Don't punch anyone in the bike.
It was more of a handoff in rugby terminology.
But also that they were heckling him.
Yeah,
they really were. I don't think that was a pleasant situation.
Yeah, we have got tomorrow a kilometer zero coming out about tifosi, the Italian fans, tifoseria, the whole concept of Italian fandom at bike races, and the Belli incident might even get a mention in that.
And after the Santa Barbara, there's a short descent. And then a short climb, a little bit higher in altitude, but obviously with the short descent, it's not a harder climb in that sense. It's Passo Bordolo. And then a long descent into Ovreto, a place we basically pass every year in the Giro. Matassona is the next climb, not that hard again. After that is the Serrara, which is, Folgheria is probably named, that rings a bell to you, is a place we often go in the Giro. And then there's a long descent, and then it finishes with the Montebondone.
Very long climb. How long, Brian? It's 22 kilometers.
Yeah, 20 kilometers with an average grading of 6.8. Hardest part is 15%. And it's, again, it's a plus 200 kilometer stage. 203.
Last time I was on Montebondone, Brian, it was the afternoon when Eufemiano Fuentes was arrested in 2006. Ivan Basso was leading the Giro. You were CSC's press officer, Ivan Basso's press officer. Memories of that day? Does it send a shiver down your spine?
No, I do remember most of it. I actually did a kilometer zero with Lionel about those years and what happened at that Giro and how it started sort of, they felt like quite surreal. And then it became very real. And for me, it was more the aftermath than the actual Giro as such, because it all happened within the very last few days of the race. Quite an intense. It started with a phone call at dinner.
It
started with a phone call
from a Spanish radio station.
Yeah, and Cadena SER, which was one of the news outlets that broke the Ubachon Puerto scandal, basically. And then I was live and direct in the studio, and I didn't speak Spanish at the time, so I was a little bit frazzled, and I thought they wanted to talk about the stage or whatever. So I passed the phone to my phone to Andrea Peron, who at the time lived in the south of Spain, in Marbella, as I say, hey, can you please talk to these Spanish journalists, because I don't really know what it is they're asking. And I could just see his face turn pale, and it was. And then everything just exploded after that, you know. But it was like a smaller, it started with a little bit of like here and there, and then it just all exploded between the Giro and the tour that year started in Strasbourg. And then, I think everyone who's followed cycling in that era will remember what that was like.
Yeah, and of course yesterday we had the stage to Cassano Maniago, which was a bit of a tribute and homage to Ivan Basso, who is now team manager at Aiolo Cometa. And it feels a little bit icky, doesn't it? Because, it feels more than a little bit icky, because Ivan never really, he confessed to having attempted to dope, and he still was suspended for that because that was equivalent to actually having doped under the WADA code. But
he came back and won a Giro in 2010.
Yeah, it seemed, to say the least, a little bit implausible.
Yeah.
And to have the Giro sort of nominally, they didn't make a big thing of it the race going to his hometown yesterday, but he was certainly involved in the negotiations to have the race come there. It's a tiny little sort of satellite suburb.
I can't imagine that it would have happened without his intervention, but yesterday was anticlimactic in a lot of ways. It was climatic in a lot of ways too, because it was a tough stage for the riders. But it was just, it made me look forward to today in a lot of ways, to put it that way.
Brian, tomorrow we've got some press conferences, not our press conference, we've got a press conference from Mark Cavendish. Lots of speculation, including from Chiro today, about what might be said in that press conference. Chiro has reported that Mark Cavendish is going to announce his retirement tomorrow. Difficult for me to comment on this because I'm sort of sworn to secrecy, but I think
Daniel, we're gonna have to work with your volume here. What's going on?
Difficult when you told something in confidence.
Okay, well, I'm happy to pull the trigger on that one.
Yeah,
then.
Go on, then you pull the trigger.
I spend more time in the Salasamba than you do here, for better.
You
or
also
for worse.
Spend a lot of time in the car with me, so
yeah,
you hear some of the go on.
Yeah, so everyone is basically, it's not a secret at this point. Mark Cavendish will announce his retirement from pro cycling tomorrow for the end of the year.
Making that call tonight.
Hope
you're not wrong. Hope it's not something else.
If you hope you're wrong, it's because we all would like to see Cavendish continue. But also think we'll talk about that tomorrow, but he's given the sport a lot, and the sport has certainly given him a lot. So, yeah, at some point that announcement will have to appear. At some point,
Mark Cavendish will retire. I should also say it's his birthday today. So happy birthday, Mark Cavendish, turned 38 today. Shares a birthday with Sean Kelly, I believe. Brian, I think that's about it from Bergamo. I'm quite sad to leave Bergamo. I'm sad we're not going up to Damimo to have some lovely polenta and some kind of stew. But we're heading to Montichiari, which is an important place in Italian cycling because it's home of their only covered velodrome. We will not be darkening the door of the velodrome tomorrow. Certainly not.
We disagree about a lot of things, but when it comes to
track cycling,
to that, there's
we're singing from the same hymn sheet.
Quiet,
Brian.
Moment in the in
we're
the
gonna car. Bid the listeners buonasera at this point, and we'll be back with Kilometer Zero tomorrow about the tifosi, the Italian fans, and then we'll be back with our usual post-stage episode from Monte Bondone on Tuesday.
Buonasera.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.